There are calls for law enforcement to do more to prevent mass shootings, but there are legal constraints.
The Constitution grants us free speech rights as well as Second Amendment rights to gun ownership. So when it comes to investigating threats at home, the FBI is much more constrained in what it can do compared to its work with international terrorism.
And could governments around the world be doing more to take advantage of super low bond yields?
The attitudes and the legacy of the financial crisis mean that governments are still very reluctant to spend a lot of money. So even though Germany could spend quite a considerable amount without even taking on extra debt, it still has this reluctance to loosen the purse strings.
This is What's News from the Wall Street Journal. I'm Charlie Turner in New York. We'll have those stories in a moment. First, here are some other stories we're following. Two top Fed officials, Philadelphia Fed President Patrick Harker and Kansas City Fed President Esther George, indicated Thursday that they would not support further interest rate cuts. In a series of interviews timed for Friday's start of the Fed's Jackson Hole Economic Symposium, which she hosts, Ms. George said she would be happy to leave rates where they are, absent some weakness or strength in the economy. Ms. George is a voting member of the Fed Interest Rate Committee who did not back the July interest rate cut. In a subsequent interview, Philadelphia Fed President Harker said he reluctantly supported the July rate cut, but now wants to keep rates steady. Harker is a non-voting member of the Federal Reserve's rate-setting committee. Fed Chair Jerome Powell will speak Friday morning at the Jackson Hole Symposium. The Wall Street Journal's Nick Timiraos says the speech comes at a time during which the Fed chief is under a lot of scrutiny.
Jerome Powell is entering the most perilous phase of his tenure as chairman of the Federal Reserve. He's trying to keep the U.S. economy from slowing into a recession, but he is facing increasing blame from President Trump, who's unhappy over volatile global markets and a slowing U.S. economy. This will come to a front at the Fed's annual retreat in Jackson Hole, Wyoming this week, where Powell is set to speak. Investors are hungry for clues about the Fed's next move. Recession fears are growing, and there's an election just around the corner. The stakes are high.
In some other news, another retailer is reporting good earnings results. Dick's Sporting Goods reported its first positive quarterly same-store sales in about 2 years and boosted its fiscal year outlook. The company's same-store sales climbed 3.2% in the second quarter, topping analysts' estimates. The last time Dick's Sporting Goods reported positive same-store sales was in the second quarter of fiscal 2017. On Wednesday, Target and Lowe's reported better-than-expected results. Large telecom companies and attorneys general from every state have unveiled a new pact for combating robocalls, the latest step toward cutting off such calls before they reach a consumer's phone. Under the voluntary agreement, the companies are promising to work to prevent illegal robocalls on their networks and to work with state law enforcement investigating the call's origins. Among the company's promises, to provide customers with free call blocking technology, investigate and trace illegal calls, and confirm the identity of their commercial customers as part of cooperation with law enforcement. In the wake of mass shootings, such as the recent attacks in El Paso and Dayton, there have been calls for federal law enforcement to take a proactive stance to prevent such attacks. But the Wall Street Journal's Sadie Gurman says there are legal hurdles to that approach. Sadie, recent mass shootings inspired by white supremacy or white nationalist ideologies have boosted demands for the government, mainly the FBI, to do more to guard against domestic terrorism. But you write that events in the run-up to the white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017 highlight the limits of the FBI to be proactive against these attacks. Why couldn't the FBI intervene more effectively to head off something like what happened in Charlottesville?
Well, it's relatively simple. I mean, the Constitution grants us free speech rights as well as Second Amendment rights to gun ownership. So when it comes to investigating threats at home, the FBI is much more constrained in what it can do compared to its work with international terrorism. So in a case like the Charlottesville white nationalist rally, what you have is a situation where the best that the FBI can do is forward potential threats, things like bravado, certain rhetoric within limits to local authorities who have greater latitude to intervene, but that doesn't really get to, you know, the preventative measures that people are looking for.
Aren't there also limits on surveillance as far as what the FBI or other investigators can do?
That's right. When the FBI is investigating a terrorist threat overseas, agents have much more latitude when it comes to things like wiretapping and other surveillance warrants that they just don't have when it comes to investigating domestic threats because of our civil liberties. And so the FBI is very constrained in what it can do in terms of, you know, monitoring these threats.
Would more people help? I know that the FBI shifted more resources to combat international terrorism in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. Would more personnel make it more effective, or would it still run up against things like the Constitution?
Well, that's the thing. The FBI can throw more bodies at this problem, but many agents and people within the Justice Department believe that without a change to the actual law, there's little that they can do to, you know, investigate these threats before they happen. So there is some appetite, but it's been relatively limited for a statute that, you know, like a so-called domestic terrorism statute that would allow for more preventative measures being taken. But it's not an easy thing to legislate for the same reasons we've discussed, because our civil liberties, you know, protect us from these things, and that any sort of statute would run up against that.
So a change in the Constitution would have to happen in order for a domestic terrorism law to pass?
Well, that's not necessarily true. There are some limited measures that Congress could take. The bigger question is how much of this is a feel-good political thing and how much appetite is there on Capitol Hill to actually put some of this in place. There's been different proposals bandied about the Justice Department for years, and they've never gained the traction to actually be something that's been seriously considered. So I think we're a long ways out. But after every one of these incidents, people call for, you know, again, call for change, and it's just a tricky thing to legislate.
What has the U.S. done in recent years to combat domestic threats besides the FBI lending support in the run-up to the Charlottesville event?
Well, the FBI has said it does consider domestic terrorism a top priority, and it has reallocated resources to investigating that threat. And agents are working more closely with hate crimes prosecutors because there's no federal domestic terrorism statute. Prosecutors have to bring other kinds of charges, and often those charges are hate crimes. So what the FBI has been doing is working more closely with hate crimes investigators to see if there's any sort of overlap or any sort of intelligence sharing that they can do to help ward against these threats. So there is definitely an increased attention to this. But again, the agency is limited in what it can do.
You're right that one thing that could work is treating domestic hate groups as, say, criminal enterprises. You know, the FBI can pursue RICO charges or something.
Yes, there is a contingent of FBI officials who believe that, you know, they already have the tools to prosecute these people as criminals. Basically, they already have criminal enterprise statutes and hate crime statutes that bring steep penalties when somebody's convicted. So there is the argument to be made that much of this is a political debate rather than an actual debate about changing the law, that this is just sort of a feel-good thing that happens in the aftermath of these shootings.
Wall Street Journal reporter Sadie Gurman joining us from Washington. Thanks, Sadie.
Thank you.
Next, we've seen bond yields fall to record lows recently in many countries. Yet, the Wall Street Journal's Anna Isaac says many governments have not responded by locking in ultra-low rates for quite a long time through the sale of so-called century bonds. Anna spoke with Sam Westren.
First things first, could you just tell me what we mean by ultra-long bonds?
The bonds that you would hear most of the time referenced when you're reading about them would be something called the 10-year benchmark. Now, you also get 2-year bonds, 3-year bonds, 5-year bonds, 10-year benchmark. Those would be your traditional length bonds. For about 30 years or so, we have had some longer duration bonds. We've had 30-year bonds for quite some time. But we've seen since 2016 a move towards issuing these so-called century bonds, where we've got the likes of Argentina and Ireland and Belgium issuing ones that stretch out by, you know, to 100 years. You've got others offering sort of 50 years. And also the general movement from these different countries' debt management offices, these places that issue these government bonds, has been to offer longer duration, because we've seen the demand for bonds overall go up so much, partly as a result of looking for safe havens recently because of poor economic data, but also because people have had a harder time getting hold of bonds because central banks have been buying them up. So you've had a scarcity problem. And the point about government bonds that has always made them relatively safe is that they're not limitless. They're always just only a certain amount from a fiscally prudent government. You know, Germany, which has a very deep negative yield across most of its bond classes at the moment, and we've seen the first auction of a 30-year bond that had a negative yield. for the first time. It's known as a fiscally prudent nation, so you know that they're going to be scarce. There's not that much government debt to buy. So that generally keeps quite strong demand for these, especially at a time of poor economic data. But also as we enter a world of potentially quantitative easing, Mark II, as the European Central Bank tries to reboot the Eurozone economy.
So we're in a moment right now where demand for bonds is very, very strong. But we haven't traditionally seen these ultra-long bonds utilised too much by governments. Is it now the case that we might start to begin seeing more of them?
Yes. So what you're seeing from a lot of central bankers, and some are hinting and some are saying explicitly, but what they are suggesting is that while they will do what they can to stimulate the economy with lower, even negative interest rates by restarting some bond buying programs that we call quantitative easing, the cupboard is getting a bit bare. And after years and years and years of relatively reduced government spending, because government debt had got so high, so if you look at, we tend to use GDP, so output compared to debt, to get a ratio to try and work out how big a country's debt is, those ratios got very, very high in the 2008 financial crisis. Governments were really running out of their ability to sort of generate cash. So we had, in the UK, we had austerity. In other countries, you saw governments really sort of tightening their belt. They weren't going for a big fiscal boost. They were relying on their central banks. Now, after relying for central banks for a decade, they're having the pressure put back on them as governments saying, come on, you need to spend more. That's going to stimulate the economy and that might help kickstart growth and inflation in areas where we're not seeing it. And now is a really cheap time to borrow. So that's the point that brings us back to this, long duration, negative yield or very low yield bonds. It's a cheap time for governments to borrow. So people are paying the German government to lend them money with these negative yields. So people are saying, right, okay, especially Germany, the biggest economy in the Eurozone area, why isn't it splashing the cash? Why isn't it sort of taking on lots of cheap debt and spending a lot of money? Well, Germany not only can take on a lot of cheap debt, it has a massive surplus, but the attitudes and the legacy of the financial crisis mean that governments are still very reluctant to spend a lot of money. So even though Germany could spend quite considerable amount without even taking on extra debt, it still has this reluctance to loosen the purse strings because it's concerned that that would send a signal to other states within the Eurozone area that have less strong public finances to say, okay, guys, yeah, you go ahead as well. We're going to spend big now. So you're seeing that, that deep reluctance, despite the fact that it's extraordinarily easy for the likes of Germany and other Eurozone states to take on debt at the moment. They're still too scared. They're still the legacy, the scars of the financial crisis run too deep.
And focusing on the states, you quoted someone as saying this is absolutely something that the Treasury should be taking advantage of. Is it likely that we might see ultra long bonds in the states?
So when we're looking at the US, it's a very different picture from, say, as we've just discussed with Germany. With the US, what we're seeing is we are seeing yields of below 2%, which is very low for the US. It's very cheap for it to borrow. And the likes of, Adam Posen, who you've just mentioned, he's president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He's saying there's no reason for the US to hesitate. There's free money on the table for the US, he's saying. But you have to look at the overall state of government finances, and following considerable tax cuts from the Trump administration, there are concerns over how robust the US balance sheet could look going forward. So there's still a sense in which people are reluctant to sort of cash in on that cheap borrowing.
The Wall Street Journal's Anna Isaac. And that's What's News for Thursday afternoon. I'm Charlie Turner at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.